arranging for me to be here. This is, I guess, loud. The other end of what quantum gravity might be about, and that is what quantum gravity has to do with space-time. So I can say rather simply what my concerns for quantum gravity will be for today's talk. And that is that if you have a quantum theory of gravity, you might want it to do a lot of things. But one of them is that it should, in one way or another, contain general relativity as the appropriate limit. And what we know from general relativity that seems to be the difficult part is that it is a theory of dynamical spacetime. That is, the physical quantities in GR are diffeomorphism invariant, if you like, which means events and their causal relations. Now, events are physical things, so ultimately you want events to be quantum. So how do you deal with dynamical spacetime if the world is made of quantum stuff? So my task for today would be to make something that sounds hard look easy. And this is to show how to describe a world that is quantum before there was space-time. So people have talked about such things, but it's considered to be, I don't know, strange or woolly or weird. But in fact, one can say concretely how to describe such a thing. And the great thing is that you could actually do things in this context. First of all, you can describe emergent physics from such an object. In fact, more easily than other approaches or more conservative ways of going about dynamical spacetimes that have been tried before. And we'll even suggest its own phenomenology. That is something that I'm very excited about. So since space-time is what I care about, let me make a list of approaches to quantum gravity according to how it is that they deal with space-time. So first of all, you could put together quantum field theory-like ways of understanding quantum gravity. So these range from black hole thermodynamics, of what you can get from quantum field theory on a curved background, and fancier versions of quantum field theory on a space-time, such as string theory or membrane theory or non-commutative geometry and so on. In all of these cases, you have various forms of quantum fields, very exotic in some situations, but they live on a given background. Then there are so-called background-independent approaches to quantum gravity. There, what you want to do is avoid having a fixed background, a fixed space-time that your fields live on. And I guess you could split the background-independent approaches, again, into two categories. The one that has been studied most, in one way or another, involves a superposition of geometries. So the idea is that your basic fields in general relativity are things like the metric and curvature, and you try to get a quantum version of that, which leads you to consider things like superpositions of spacetimes. But of course, there's another way to be background independent, which is to deal with something that was there before spacetime. And then there are also condensed matter approaches, which range from simple analogies like making an acoustic analog of a black hole that you could test in the lab, or a Bose-Einstein version of it, to, again, pre-space-time condensed matter systems, which would like to address the question of how does space-time emerge from something more fundamental. So what I want to do is go in, well, I guess, in what I had before, it would look like the first one is nice, but it's unlikely to tell me very much about dynamical space-time. Maybe in some complicated way I could extract some information if the space-time of the background is somehow auxiliary, but that is not really what is done. So the background-independent ones seem to be most promising. But the ones where you consider a superposition of space-times, It has been studied for decades now, and I've studied a lot too, and it encounters very serious problems in trying to derive a classical space-time out of such an object. Not surprisingly, when you are implementing a quantum version of diffeomorphism invariants, you end up having serious difficulties in defining both observables and dealing with the dynamics, which then means the low energy limit general relativity is very hard to get out. So I don't have a lot of time to go into the details how to do this. So I will instead go straight into the object that we'll consider. And I will first give you the definition of the object, and then we'll go into the rest of the talk, discusses what this is and what it can do for you. So consider this. I start with a directed graph that's a bunch of vertices connected by arrows. And when, for example, you have an arrow going from X to Y, then you say that X and Y are related, or Y follows X. If there is no sequence of arrows relating two of those vertices, such as X and Z, then they're not related. And I will ask that there are no cycles, so you can't go round a cycle of arrows and come back to the same point. If you give me such a graph, I can turn it into a graph of quantum systems by a very straightforward correspondence. So every vertex in my graph will become a finite dimensional state space. Every time I have two unrelated vertices, I will consider them as independent. And so the corresponding, the joined state space will be the tensor product of the two. If I have a relation, such as from X to Y, then I will have a map that takes me from the state space at X to the state space of Y, or more precisely, from the algebra of operators on X to the algebra of operators on Y, that will be completely positive. What is a completely positive map? It's generally the way that quantum systems in nature evolve when they're open. So if you have a map, phi, from density matrices at X to density matrices at Y, it is completely positive when it is linear and positive. So it takes density matrices to density matrices, trace preserving. And you need one more condition. If I have my quantum system, and now I consider it together with another auxiliary quantum system, B, that does nothing. So I extend my map phi to phi times the identity on B, I should still go from density matrices to density matrices. So this is the condition of complete positivity. So if you miss the last condition, so the first part is natural if you want to go from density matrices to density matrices. The last condition gets rid of operations that you could do on a density matrix that are not evolution, such as taking the transpose, satisfies all of these conditions and not that. So if you have a completely positive map, then you have a way to go from density matrices here to density matrices there. But are these conditions enough to ensure that the way the information flows in this system reflects the directed graph under it? So, for example, we tend to understand things in the following way. You could have here this configuration. This is a little directed graph. And what you would think of if my arrows represent where the information goes, this would say that everything that left X has gone to this system of two guys up here. So if you like, that's what you would normally think of if you say that these two guys are the complete future of X. And the reverse, everything that has reached Y has come from these two guys of the past. So these two, the system of two independent guys of the past is the complete past of Y. And let me call a situation where all the information that leaves the thing at the bottom, the in, reaches the out, a complete pair. So there are no arrows leaving this set and going somewhere outside and the reverse. So what you would normally want is every time you encounter such a configuration in your directed graph, you would like to have a unitary evolution. That's what you understand by unitary evolution. Similarly, if I gave you a unitary evolution from here to there, you would like to make sure that you can tell which one of these different configurations you have inside, which way did information go. So it turns out that if you add a bunch of nice axioms, which I'm not going to go into, they're very straightforward in my definition, then you find that you get things where you want them. You get unitary maps for complete pairs, even though your fundamentally your description is in terms of CP completely positive evolution. And you can distinguish the different microcausality configurations. So you can tell, if I give you a unitary, which one it is. So then I'm justified to say that the directed graph is a causal structure. But then whose causal structure is it? So first version, you can try a very conservative one, where the causal structure is that of a fixed background. So what I'm considering is C is just a discretization of a Lorentzian spacetime. Then all that I have is a discrete analog of quantum field theory. So quantum field theory, for example, in the algebraic quantum field theory form that is easiest to make a correspondence with this, you have a causal net of operator algebras. So every causally complete region of a continuous spacetime goes to a von Neumann algebra. That's your standard quantum field theory. Here, every little element x goes to a finite dimensional matrix algebra. That's very simple, but it's actually quite interesting. For example, you can use this to address a question that people often puzzle about, which is that there's a bunch of arguments that say that fundamentally there is a finite number of degrees of freedom in a finite volume. If you put that together with the fact of an expanding universe, then you seem to have a problem with unitarity. So for example, people worry if they have an S matrix formulation in a de Sitter space. Well, there's a number of things that you can say about what you think about this, but I'm not going to go into this. I would just like to say that technically, what you can see is that CP evolution underlies unitary evolution, and it's okay with this setup. It can go, CP operators can go between state space of different dimension without any particular problem. So there's a whole bunch of things that you can do, but since now my C is a fixed background, this cannot be quantum gravity. So I'm not going to linger. How do I get to be background independent rather than independent? Well, there's two ways to do that. The standard way is to say that C, my directed graph, my causal structure, is the causal structure of some metric. So the way to be background independent would be to consider a quantum superposition of all of those, which would be what I would get if I put hats on the GMUs. So that's what you would do in loop quantum gravity or spin foams, et cetera. Now, the thing is that you actually end up with pretty horrible objects, of which you have to get back from those to the classical limit of the GMU. And I've spent several years trying to understand those. And as far as I can tell, it's very hard to deal with a superposition of causal structures. I could give a whole talk on that, but basically the problem is that defining observables and dynamics is very hard, and without that, it's very difficult to get back to low energy limit or to extract an effective theory out of this big guy here. So there's another way, though, that I could be background independent, is to say that C is the causal order of a quantum system that is before spacetime. That is, general relativity and GMU are only an effective description, will only apply at a certain level. In a background independent context, this means that we live in a low energy other causal structure. Let's call C prime our causal structure, and then there is some underlying quantum system, which I will call the thing that has causal structure C. So what I want to do, so far it looks very abstract, but I want to show you how you can actually go from this to that, and as well as what can you tell about the relationship of the two. I'm not going to solve quantum gravity today, unfortunately. Next year's talk, I suppose. But I want to show you that you can actually tell a lot of things about the relationship between the two just by starting to consider this problem seriously. And to do that, I need tools. I need tools that do not depend on a background spacetime. I've hoped for a long time to be able to use straightforward condensed matter tools to get effective GR out of an underlying system, but it's very hard because everything that you do in condensed matter refers to a background geometry. If you coarse grain, you take double the lattice spacing. That means that you take double the observables, which is very hard to do if you don't have a background. But I have a whole other set of tools that my friends that do quantum information theory have, which apply here straightforwardly. So the quantum causal history I was showing you, if I show it to any quantum information theorist, they would say, well, yeah, I know, I work with that every day. It's a quantum information processing system. C is my circuit, and I have finite dimensional state spaces on that. So this is not very deep, but it lets me do something very important. I can use this analogy and their tools to have a notion of effective degree of freedom without a background. That will be the information protected under the microscopic evolution. The people building quantum computers care about protecting information from external noise. I just care about protecting information from the system itself, but it's basically the same thing. So this way, I can get effective degrees of freedom, and then the idea is simple, that the dynamics of the protected degrees of freedom will define the causal structure of our spacetime. So what is a protected degree of freedom? Well, first of all, let me become a little more specific by giving you an example of a system that you might consider. So one very common type of state that is used in background-dependent quantum gravity is given by networks. So I have a network, a graph, like this. And the important thing is that subgraphs of that correspond to finite dimensional state spaces. For example, that is the case with spin networks in loop quantum gravity, in conformal field theory. These are pretty common objects. In these theories, generically, the state space has this form. You take for every given graph, embedded in a topological free space, you take the tensor product of all the individual state spaces of every subgraph, and you sum over the boundary data. So if this state space and this one share some boundary data on this edge, then you have to sum over them. And then you take the direct sum of all the graphs that you can consider of that form. And there's a very common type of evolution people consider on that system. And this is made by local operations of the graph. So these three are three ways that I can change from one graph to the next graph. These three moves on graphs define an evolution algebra. So now I have a state space and an evolution. So I now can use their tool. They say that a subsystem, let's call it HB, of my state space will be protected under the evolution if there is a decomposition of H of this form, where HB is the protected part, K is an orthogonal complement of this, such that when I evolve this block of my state space, the state of B remains unchanged, and A just does whatever, it becomes a mess. So then I say that B is protected. And therefore, I can use that as an emergent degree of freedom. And it's funny, so usually it's very hard to find this decomposition from that reveals. So here, it's very non-trivial if I give you a state space to find a decomposition that reveals a subsystem that is noiseless. So people construct algorithms and complicated ways to do that. But in our systems, there actually has been a whole bunch of protected subsystems that have been under our nose forever, and nobody looked at them before we considered this way of addressing this problem. So, take this particular graph. In the way I've described it to you, what you're supposed to do is consider the graph split into two subgraphs. So the contribution of this graph to the state space is H1 tensor H2. Well, I can choose a different decomposition. The one that has this subgraph, this one here, and one in the middle. What I have done is that H1 prime and H2 prime, unlike H1 and H2, have no braiding in them. So H2 is twisted here. The primed quantities are defined to be untwisted. So in this new decomposition, I now have that the contribution of this graph to the state space is of this form. And it's not hard to check that with the evolution moves I gave you before, you cannot do anything to the braid part. You can expand or do whatever you want to the primed quantities, but not to the B parts of your state space. So if I give you my graph here and you do the evolution in the moves that I gave you, you will get two huge messes eventually, but somewhere in the outcome, the original braid will still be there. That is, braiding is protected under the evolution. It's interesting because, well, now you can ask me the question of what information does the braiding represent? It is protected, therefore it should be important for any effective theory of those guys. If I have a way of approximating them at a low energy, this protected information should play a role. Now, one question is, what is the role of those? And we had some ideas of maybe they correspond to matter that I'm not going to go into. But the point is that there is a lot of information that nobody ever looked at before. And these are very common states, once again. The other very interesting part of this is that finding protected or effective degrees of freedom through this system relies on the evolution. This is precisely what has been very hard to do in quantum geometry, sum over histories, background in independent quantum gravity. And it is, of course, what you should expect, that it's important, that the dynamics is really what determines an effective theory. So now I would love to tell you what I know so far about how you might be able to go from protected degrees of freedom to a space-time. But unfortunately, it takes longer than the 3 minutes I have, and I've written a bunch of papers on ways to do this, and please ask me afterwards. I would like to tell you something else instead before that. So if I could get, I now have a way of describing the universe in terms of quantum systems on a directed graph. From this thing, it has no space-time, I can extract effective degrees of freedom. Now, if I could, from the effective degrees of freedom, also get a space-time, I would be done. That would be a quantum theory of gravity. So I hesitate, and I say, well, could I actually get some useful information before I'm done? Because, of course, it would be a very difficult problem. And, well, my lesson from trying to apply ideas from condensed matter physics to these type of problems was that if you don't have some contact with what you observe in the real world, you're not going to get very far. So, in fact, there is a very interesting thing that you can observe about these systems that, again, with hindsight, it would be obvious, just as the way that the braids were preserved under the moves that we have always used for years was obvious, but we didn't discover it before we tried this method. So this is this. If you say that you have a quantum world before space-time, if you say that space-time is only an effective concept, what you're also saying is that locality is only an effective concept. So the more specific way to say that in my context is that the original decomposition of my state space and the dynamics of that defines a certain notion of macro locality And the new decomposition defines a notion of macrolocality. The main point that this method demonstrates is that they do not coincide. And it's not that they don't coincide up to Planck scale. It's the effective degrees of freedom are everywhere in the underlying ones. So the effective locality, the effective degrees of freedom are everywhere in the fundamental ones. And if you reverse this, what you conclude is that microlocality, the fundamental evolution, is really non-local with respect to us. And I came to that through this route of quantum causal histories and protected degrees of freedom. But in fact, you could come to the same conclusion if you really think that space-time is only applicable at a certain level. So exactly how to get this from that is not a very easy thing to do. But of course, one can always do a phenomenology of that type that capture this. So that's what we are busy modeling right now. So I'm throwing out all the motivation of where things came from. And you can make a very simple type of phenomenology where you take a flat space, and on that, you add non-local connections. You add a certain amount of non-locality, and its particular feature, which is justified from these arguments here, is that it should be independent of distance. And the idea is to apply this to early universe physics. So for example, you can kind of easily use such a thing to solve the horizon problem, since basically your extrapolation of our current causal structure at the beginning doesn't apply anymore. But you have to do that at the same time as agreeing with other observations, and that is currently in progress, and maybe next door. So just to summarize, my starting point is, of course, that space-time is dynamical because it is physical. It is made up of events, which are physical processes. And I wanted to do the same thing in a quantum context with quantum causal histories. So here my processes are quantum. So the idea is that space-time geometry is an emergent concept, and it describes the effective dynamics of the protected subsystems in my quantum universe. And the conclusion from this that I focused on today is that emergent space-time means emergent locality beyond Planck scale corrections. And that should have observable consequences. Thank you.